All right, good morning, listeners, and welcome to this week's News from the Drug War Front. My name is Jeff, and my co-presenter is Marion. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, listener. How are we this morning on this damp morning, for heaven's sake?
I'm actually enjoying the weather, to be candid.
Yeah, you love it, don't you, Jeffrey? Come on, everybody, wake up and be proud of your height. Get up and have a look out the window. It's cloudy, but it's nice weather.
I mean, the hot weather's going to come, isn't it?
It will eventually, and it'll knock us sideways, Jeffrey, but right at the moment, it's cruisy weather, isn't it? As long as you don't wear glasses, because I find that raindrops down the glasses make it really difficult to read or see signs.
I'll take your word for it. How about the storms, though, in northern New South Wales? Byron Bay's beach has disappeared.
I have a sister in the Gold Coast and in a penthouse, for crying out loud. Doesn't mean I'm rich, gang. Just means she is. In a penthouse, I understand, and I have a niece who's down just south of where the storms are, just north of Newcastle in Port Stephens or thereabouts, and a friend who's up at Port Macquarie. So, yes, I worry a lot about them and their ability to connect with people and to stay above the high. I know a lot of people live around the Bellingen area because it was kind of evacuation two from Canberra. Like, the first lot went to Cairns, second lot went to Bellingen. That's of my group anyway, my era. So, yes, they're all there, I suppose, getting swamped by the Bellingen River, which is a bit sad.
Another erratic weather
event. Yes, another. More of the erratic wet pattern behaviour. What's the rest of summer going to be like, Jeffrey, I wonder? It has been so crazy.
Could be anything, Marion.
Yeah, but it's principally climate change. Surprise!
Hello. All right, welcome, listeners, to this week's edition of News from the Drug War Front, brought to you as ever by CARMA, the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy. CARMA is a peer-based community-controlled drug user organisation. Now, the community of people who inject drugs were actually very instrumental to the successful public health response to the HIV/AIDS epidemic in Australia back in the 1980s. And this community remains active in disseminating information into their community about other blood-borne viruses, like hepatitis C, and the harms caused by prohibition. Many human rights abuses of people who use drugs continue as a result of prohibition. And we'd like to take this opportunity to acknowledge the legacy of the peers who went before us and to reaffirm our commitment to fighting the effects of stigma and criminalisation in all of their manifestations.
Indeed.
So the show aims to inform and educate listeners about the failure of the war on people who use drugs and also promote what CARMA does and also what other agencies in the sector do in the ACT.
That's right. And we've actually been interviewing people over the last few weeks from time to time on the services that have been provided. CARMA, however, is the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy and Canberra's only peer-based drug user group. CARMA provides a wide range of services, including client advocacy, peer treatment support, education, representation, information, creative arts, mentoring and referrals. The CARMA office is located in the Church's Centre at Shop 17, Level 1, 54 Belconnen Way, Benjamin Way in Belconnen. CARMA's office hours are 10 a.m. to 4 p.m, Monday to Friday, and the office number is 62533643. That's 62533643. CARMA continues to run opioid overdose recognition and response with naloxone workshops and also does brief interventions with individual clients. Workers at other alcohol and other drug agencies in the ACT can also receive training and have done so. CARMA can also assist with issues related to opioid maintenance treatment, that's methadone or buprenorphine in the ACT, the availability of Buvidal.
Yeah,
too. That's one we need to add to that, which is the longer-lasting one. Yep. The availability of detox and rehab services in the ACT, issues of stigma and discrimination, problems with getting access to proper pain relief, which is always a huge issue, but in fact all issues faced by people impacted by prohibition and the war on people who use drugs.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, the contents of this News from the Drug War Front broadcast does not necessarily reflect the views and or the policies of the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy. CARMA does not condone nor condemn drug use and does not promote illegal activity. Karma recognises that drug use happens, and as such, Karma focuses on harm reduction messages, drug treatment support services, advocacy and community development. Karma seeks to reduce the harms associated with drug use as well as the harms associated with the criminalisation of drug use through the provision of empowering programs that concentrate on community development, person-centred healthcare and equity of health service delivery for all people. Now, before we move on with the song and get into the show proper, I thought we'd perhaps reflect for listeners who were unable to attend the big culmination.
Yes, but
to the...
we have been talking about the 16 days of action that was so successful. Last Thursday, we had a great... People, we had a march that was so inspiring and so... We were so enthusiastic, Jeff, and so wound up over it. We marched from Karma premises down to Margaret Timpson Park in Belconnen, and then wrapped trees in orange. And Mary, did you see Mary's scarf? Actually covered almost the whole of a trunk of a tree.
It's a work
which
of
was
art.
Just fabulously done. I was so impressed.
Yeah.
But the enthusiasm and the excitement, just to let people know, no violence on women, particularly women who use drugs, but stop the violence. Promote human rights among everybody but women who use drugs in particular, because that was the focus of the 16 days. And we had such a good time, such a good turn up to the march, I thought, for our little organisation just sticking our toes in the water. And all power to Natasha and the volunteers who came and supported us so well. It was just wonderful. Well, we supported them, really, Jeffrey, if you think about it. We just kind of snuck in there and got up to the top of the line.
Because, it was like a step back in time, wasn't it? We were back in our youth.
I remember talking to you about it, Jeffrey. What we used to do in the old days, the traditions of going to a demo, what had to happen. But, of course, there's demonstrations and there's demonstrations, but it was a very rewarding exercise. The 16 days of action is a long time to maintain the rage, but it's nothing in the life of a woman who's prone to domestic violence or personal violence.
Mm.
So 16 days of action is the least that we can do.
We should have a national government
absolutely
all-year campaign.
Hoped that we could have got more on board, but we... Certainly it was international, nonetheless,
yeah,
Jeffrey,
it's
was
global,
it not?
It's a global campaign.
It's a global campaign, and the colour orange that was we were using to highlight or bring attention to us as demonstrators was also the colour that the globe in front of the United Nations building in New York had been coloured orange for the time. So that was really exciting too.
Yeah.
And Thursday, of course, was International Human Rights Day. So we started on, 16 days earlier than that was, it was just before World AIDS Day. I think it was the
25th November,
day,
I think.
25th
all...
of November, yep. And went through to International Human Rights Day. So it was really potent, and the activities that we undertook just generated so much emotive support. Yeah, and so much. It was a really good feeling. Thursday's march, I felt like I was high as a kite, and I hadn't had anything
That's
extra.
Awesome, isn't it? Yeah, no, there's something special about
it. It was, and collective action just brings such a lot of emotion. Yeah, when you turn around and. And we were singing I Am Woman, remember? And I turned around and I said, I am strong. And turned around and everyone goes, strong. And I just thought, oh, you are wonderful, you people.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And thanks to, Natasha, Laney, everyone who was involved.
Absolutely.
And people could contribute in so many ways, wasn't there? There was petitions, there was arts and crafts, there was, empowerment, there was self-defence class.
We had that. That was great. I was so excited to learn that. Learned a few ways, more ways of self-defence, I don't need it as much as I used to in the old days, but I think that I could manage it even with my fragile bones, because I'm 68 now, gang, having turned a year older as of last week. I really am feeling that, can I afford to defend myself? Well, yes, I can. And in fact, I need to. If put upon by someone, if confronted with violence, I need to be able to know how to disarm somebody, or not taking their arms off or taking whatever weapons they've got, but just discombobulate them, if you like, just upset their balance because they think that I'm going to put up with it. Men think that women are going to put up with it,
or just vulnerable,
people who are going to be violent, not always men, people who are going to be violent tend to do it by surprise and think that they're going to get away with it, because if they do it by surprise, you'll be knocked out before they can say anything. But now I've learned a little bit more about how to get my balance, get my center, and how to defend or protect myself.
Yeah, it was really good.
It was really good and very quick.
Yeah.
Very simple strategies, Jeffrey. And I really would exhort women and men who are feeling that they are imposed upon too to learn a little bit of self-defense. Mm. It's quite easy. And value yourself, love yourself enough to feel that you deserve it. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. But it was a wonderful 16 days.
Oh, it was. Yeah.
Well worth the effort and our little bit of a contribution to a global, you know,
global
atrocity. Really.
Yes, it was fabulous. We were, and having Ruth in last week was really
that
particularly
was great
good,
too.
Wasn't
yeah,
it?
That was really good timing. Yes, no, it was nice having Ruth on the show.
It was a nice change, yes.
All right, let's go to a song. I've picked Limp Bizkit and My Way, bit of an up-tempo one, get the show rolling. Here's Limp Bizkit. All right, it's about 13 minutes to 11. You're with Jeff and Marin. This is News from the Drug War Front, and that was Limp Bizkit with the track My Way.
And you're on public radio, 2XX.
2XX, 98.3 FM, yes.
People-powered radio.
And, while Marin's mentioned community radio, do seriously consider becoming a financial supporter of 2XX. If you like our show or any of the other 60-plus original shows produced by volunteers each and every week. We've got a major story on the local scene, and I actually have a copy of today's Canberra Times in my hand. And look, we don't normally need just read articles from the day's paper, but I think this one's worth reading.
Worth reading, yep.
ACT Politics, a Liberal leader says Labor should have taken their drugs plan to the election. The Canberra Liberals say that ACT Labor has blindsided Canberrans and should have taken its proposed drug decriminalisation laws to the October Territory election. Mm-hmm. And there's been debate in the last few days about Michael Pettison, Labor backbencher.
That's right.
Proposing this.
This was actually on the books before the election.
Yes.
And I think that Mr. Pettison said that Ms. Lee was being a bit disingenuous, was the word he used, because that was on the books. They do have to put up a list of legislation that is to be proposed.
Yes, there's a whole sequence.
The fact that they didn't take it, it is a private member's bill, not necessarily
from the
whole government. Yeah. So he's pushing it uphill, doing it by himself anyway, but has managed to glean support. So, disingenuous, I think, is a very appropriate word. It could, there's a word that starts with L that probably reflects it more accurately, but nonetheless, that's a good word.
Backbencher Michael Pattison says he will introduce his private members' bill in the first sitting week of the ACT Legislative Assembly next year. It would allow people to be dealt with through civil penalties for possessing drugs, including heroin, ice and MDMA. Liberal leader and Shadow Attorney General Elizabeth Lee said the party was open to working with the government on the proposed legislation, but the community should have been consulted before it was sprung onto them. Mr. Pettison wants to introduce civil fines for possession of up to 2 grams of ice, cocaine, and 0.5 grams of MDMA. Other drugs like LSD and amphetamines would also be included in the private members' bill. The consultation draft bill, seen by the Canberra Times, would allow police to issue $100 fines to people caught with drugs instead of charging them criminally, which is a significant change.
It's a big difference
to drug laws. Quote, the biggest concern we had in this comes less than 2 months after the ACT election. There was no indication whatsoever in the lead up to the election that this was even on Labor's radar, Ms. Lee said. I'm very concerned there's been a complete lack of consultation with our health experts, with legal experts, and with various stakeholders, including people who have experience in this space. Ms. Lee said she supported any measures that would reduce the harms of drugs, but I don't think it needs to be mutually exclusive. To be a mutually exclusive thing, she said. On the one hand, from a criminal justice perspective, on the other hand, from a health perspective, I think there is scope and room for looking at it holistically. Australian Federal Police Association President Alex Caruana says the organisation didn't necessarily oppose the idea, but questioned whether the ACT had the necessary health programs in place. And is quoted as saying, there is also a large jump from cannabis to MDMA and then to heroin and ice, which will require a lot more consultation and engagement, he said. Mr. Caruana said he was also disappointed Mr. Pettison had not consulted with the organisation before releasing the consultation draft legislation. Quote, "We've had some great early day discussions with the ACT Greens on drug reform and raising the age of criminal responsibility. If the ACT Greens can consult before legislative work is done on matters, why can't ACT Labor members?" He said.
I find that too is a little bit disingenuous. This concept has been around for some time, Geoffrey. So the idea that there was some legislation on the books, as I said earlier, had to be notified to the members of Parliament. And the consultation actually has been going on for years and years.
Yeah.
It has. And the answers have never been any different. Yes, we want change. Yes, change the rate at which money is provided, particularly harm reduction money, send it to the places where it is important, not just to interdiction. Anyway.
Invest in services.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Invest in the services, but you've got to take money out of other services first. The article goes on. Mr. Pedersen says, consultation can be done and amendments made while the bill is before the Legislative Assembly. Chief Minister Andrew Barr said he personally supported drug decriminalisation. He said Cabinet would consider the bill and any proposed amendments multiple times throughout next year. It may then come before the Legislative Assembly for a vote towards the end of 2021, he said. Barrister and former President of the ACT Bar Association, Stephen Wybrow, welcomed the proposed legislation, saying similar proposals overseas had not, quote, opened the floodgates to more drug use. Quote, people who are dealers and manufacturers of drugs are not going to benefit from this, he said. The quote goes on, delivering people who are using drugs into health and education intervention programs is, in my view, going to be a more productive and positive approach to the problem of illicit drugs than sending them through the courts. He goes on, people would still need to understand it is not becoming legal to use these drugs, but it's being moved into a lower category of criminal offending, like a traffic infringement notice. And that makes a monumental difference to people who are subject to these charges, Geoffrey, because it leaves them, A, capable of getting a job, because the higher range of fines or of penalties with those drug laws rendered them unemployable in a lot of ways, also able to travel. If you have a conviction on or a 556A or whatever it is, an unrecorded conviction on the books, it means you can still get a visa for other countries in the world. You can still travel. It doesn't stop you. It doesn't stop your life from developing if you're an 18-year-old who gets a personal, you know, drug use possession charge. An ACT policing spokeswoman said the force would need to consider the bill in detail before forming a view on it. Quote, ACT policing is committed to harm minimisation initiatives and is always actively engaged with government and other stakeholders on strategies and legislative change, she said. That perhaps is a tad ingenuous too, because this idea of harm reduction, harm minimisation has been around for what, Geoffrey? Since 1984, we're talking nearly 40 years of harm minimisation strategies being available, and including legislative change. So I don't think subsequent generations necessarily have not been consulted. I think that the consultation has been ongoing and forever. We have been running this show, well, you and others have been running this show for 15 years at least. The war on drugs has been going since 1961, since 1956, when heroin was made into, people were actually forced to pour heroin down the drain, right? 1955 legislation, 1956, pour it down the drain. No more use of heroin in Australia, except obstetrics hospitals, one in particular in Victoria. But it was just the concept of bringing the doctors didn't like these laws anyway, let alone, you know, taking away that pain relief was just not something they ever contemplated happening. And now we're getting more and more involved in reducing the availability of pain relieving drugs and increasing the hurdles to getting access to pain relief, reducing the numbers of drugs, of pills you can get at any one time. It's becoming more and more complex, less and less responsive to community needs and more about the emotions associated with intoxication, I think, back to the moral standpoint, I reckon, anyway.
And lots of people who are suffering terrible diseases with incredible pain are being affected or prevented.
Constantly. Rebecca from the Arthritis Association, remember, Arthritis Foundation, remember saying just how demoralising and devastating it was for the introduction of those new laws on people who have chronic arthritis, and being able to get access to pain relief was just a huge hurdle that many people just couldn't be bothered jumping over. So going onto the black market for some people is a more legitimate...
Can be the only option for some.
Often, yes, yeah. Quite the only option.
Yeah. No, it's not good. We'll go to a quick song, then we'll go to the news. This is Jimmy Cliff and The Harder They Come, which I thought was a good choice.
Well, yeah.
Jimmy Cliff and The Harder They Come. It was great. You saw the movie, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And I also, over the last couple of days, I've seen a couple of docos on NITV, on 34, on... just on normal television channel.
It's a great station. Yeah.
Great stuff on there. Yeah. And they've had quite a few documentaries on black singers and really interesting stuff. And big one yesterday on B.B. King, which was just from...
Oh,
he actually
had
his last performance on stage before he went sick.
I think that's the way he wanted to go out.
He did. He said, that's how I want to go out.
Yep, we have the news. All right, you're back with Jeff and Marion.
News from the Drug War Fund.
That was very interesting about American sports teams dropping...
85 years, yeah. It took them to actually drop the name Redskins.
The Washington Redskins.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously?
Yeah, you would have thought, really, wouldn't you?
You'd think that would have gone long ago.
In the beginning, it was not a great idea.
No, it's really, really appalling stuff.
Anyway, let's go on to the national news. Hey, as a police commander, I used to ask myself, was drug use really a matter of crime? This is by Frank Hansen, TheGuardian.com, from December the 11th. Any reform the New South Wales government considers that leads to less confrontation for the cops will also be the best outcome from the community. Cops on bicycles aren't the first things that come to mind when discussing tough drug strategies, but you'd be surprised how effective they were in Cabramatta 2 decades ago. Evidence of drug use was everywhere in the Sydney suburb in the late 90s and early 2000s. Needles, bodies and dealing out in the open. I was tasked with taking charge of the Cabramatta Local Area Command during 2 difficult years of 2001 and 2002. The focus was heroin use, trafficking and the impact on the community. Tough strategies hadn't worked. Better alternatives were scant. Arrests were occurring, but like Medusa's hair, for every dealer that was taken out of play, another would crop up in their place. I think it was Medusa's head, actually. I had never before managed a local command and, truth be known, I was as sceptical as the next person in my ability to make a difference. I did have some experience, however, in developing policy needed to support the rollout of the needle and syringe exchange program. Remember, Geoffrey, I did mention that to you in the break.
Known of him for years.
Yes, I met him during that time. And Australia's first medically supervised injecting centre in King's Cross. To my way of thinking, apart from anything else, this is Frank Hansen still speaking, the less confrontation between cops and the community is always a good thing. And so I asked myself from very early on, was the possession and use of illicit drugs really a matter of crime?
That's a really important question.
It is. It's a fundamental question. You'd think that everybody would ask that. And it's one that we ask every week.
Every week,
yeah. Is it a matter of crime or is it a moral position? Certainly it's on the statute books, but should it be?
Should it be?
A crime is usually seen as inflicting some form of physical, financial or other hurt on another. Drug use is primarily an individual hurting themselves together with the fallout caused to the family, loved ones and, without doubt, the well-being of the community in which it occurs. But there's also fallout from alcohol and even secondhand smoking. Both these legal drugs often have unwanted side effects on the individual who chooses to use them. We deal with alcohol and tobacco in a completely different way than the way we treat illegal drugs. We consider them a health issue. Unless someone is assaulted or run over because the offender was drunk, yet still, the offender is not arrested for using alcohol per se, but for the consequences of its use. Somehow, we still continue treating illicit drug use as a crime, and, I might add, with little success.
Yeah, it goes on to say, recently it was revealed the New South Wales government was reconsidering how to deal with this issue. It has looked at recommendations from last year's ICE inquiry. These are unsurprisingly seen by a few former top cops as a very sensible way forward. The word, in quotes, decriminalisation has been bandied about a lot over the past week, but while the term means slightly different things to different people, it is clear the New South Wales government is reluctant to go there. They are, however, considering a much humbler but nevertheless worthwhile step towards, quote, diverting drug users away from the criminal justice system, a three strikes policy that would see a person initially given a warning or a fine instead of being charged. The question I pose is this. Apart from the clear benefits to the drug users themselves, would diversion make it safer for the cops? Undoubtedly. Anything that reduces the antagonism between would-be offenders and the cops is worthwhile. The latter may well then be seen as a catalyst for getting help, therefore making it a far safer situation for all. Allowing police to focus on diversion instead of arresting and charging is going to make the job of police far safer than what it is today. It also makes far more sense. In that respect, cannabis cautioning is a model worth considering for other illicit drugs. Illicit drug use should be seen as a health issue and dealt with the same as alcohol and tobacco. Apart from drug crime, I saw Cabramatta as a campaign for hearts and minds. The local community was suffering terribly from a proliferation of overdoses and discarded drug paraphernalia and, in particular, adverse media attention as a consequence. As an adjunct to routine policing, I introduced a team of 12 bicycle police. You can laugh now, but the sight of a police officer riding a bicycle on the local streets did several things, including providing a very mobile response to deter those intent on causing problems through their drug use, sending a message of safety and reinforcing the notion that police were keen to help make things better. Of course, I don't suggest bicycles were or are the answer to all the problems faced by our communities across the country, but I believe that unnecessary confrontation makes the job unsafe for both cops and the community. The bicycles were a very simple initiative that helped to reduce the unnecessary confrontation in Cabramatta during those very tough years. Our drug laws might seem like common sense, but they can often lead to unnecessary conflict. Any reform that the New South Wales government considers this week that leads to less confrontation for the cops will also be the best outcome for the community.
Absolutely. No, that's a really appropriate, really spot-on article, Geoffrey. I mean, it's not heavy-handed. It doesn't require an awful lot of deep thinking to realise that simple things are often the best solutions. Yeah, it's simple. The implementation of a simple project or program like putting bikes, police on bikes in the community, and you can bet the coppers that went on those bikes copped a lot of flack
at the time
from their colleagues at the time.
Yeah.
But look how many MILFs we've got, you know, riding around on bikes now, and that's actually a matter of being really fit and healthy. So you can laugh all you like at somebody on a bike, but they're healthy and they have the capacity to chase where no one else can go. But it also puts them on a platform, yeah, a level playing field with
more part of the community,
absolutely, rather than sitting in a car isolated with, you know, bulletproof glass and able to pursue people who maybe go five steps, yeah, or run five steps. But going on a bike, you're open to the community. You say, g'day, howdy, as you're riding along. You're really part of what's happening, not isolated from it. I think it's a great idea.
And how much more in the way of police resources would be available for serious crimes?
Absolutely.
Pedophiles.
Yes.
Child molesters.
Yes.
Rapists.
Arson. Also, oh, look, the bushfires. You know, how many of those were actually lit by people who were, in fact, arsonists, want to see it burn. And you just think, oh, that's, how can you be like, well, people are like that.
It's a serious crime. Yeah.
It is a serious crime. It needs to be considered as such.
But so much time's taken up with trying to, you know, implement or enforce drug laws, which really have failed, are going to keep failing.
And will not cease that. And really just need to be changed at the fundamental, you know, the philosophy needs to be implemented. You know, the idea that really what we want to do, we'd like people to stop harming themselves, but you can't do that. You can't stop people just getting intoxicated. They'll find a way to do it one way or the other.
So make it safe.
So make it as safe as you possibly can. As we say in the beginning, drug use is a fact. Whatever drug you look at, it's a fact. The difference is the legality, the legal status of the drugs. We have spent so much money on interdiction, and yes, we might be getting some large amounts of drugs left, right and centre, but not at the rate that the drugs are getting through to the local community.
Is it stopping drugs it's being available on the black market?
Not stopping people using drugs, not stopping people making recourse to those drugs, like seeking them out actively. And, yeah, I just think that he's saying be sensible, be straight and maintain that connection with the community, because once you get that, and they're doing this out in the middle of nowhere too, Jeffrey. Indigenous liaison officers, Indigenous policing. They've got to be able to look after themselves and keep each other healthy. The only problem I can see with that is that crime prevention is not seen as a matter for police by police. And I think that's an argument worth having. Law enforcement is police business. Crime prevention is a whole other piece of work, and I think that really needs serious consideration.
I agree. All right, we'll go to a song. This is your CD from John Butler Trio, Mary.
Yeah, this is called Home, and it's a really great CD. I just exhort people, John Butler's a great songwriter. This is him writing about himself and his family, but the one track that really resonates with me is Coffee, Methadone and Cigarettes.
Here's John Butler Trio. That was the John Butler Trio from the Home album, and the track was Coffee, Methadone and Cigarettes. It's about 21 minutes after 11. You're listening to News from the Drug War Front with Jeff and Marian in the 2XX studio, 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. And we're going to start with our first international story, Maz.
Yeah, this is Consider the Dealer, Supplying Drugs and Harm Reduction in the UK. This is by Renato Massetti, talkingdrugs.org, December the 8th. Ask most people to describe an online drug supplier and the words, quote, selfish, violent and evil are probably not far from their lips. Stereotypes are powerful beasts and difficult to slay. As an old-timer in the field, I remember the seismic shift that followed the emergence of legal highs with their focus on chemistry and technology. The early 2000s saw a new wave of drug use that has influenced, it seems to me, the choice of chemicals available, as well as the consistently unimaginative and ineffective legal framework we are burdened with in the UK.
So it's not just here.
No, it isn't just here, strangely. Policy stayed frozen in shock while life changed. The drugs changed, and importantly, drugs began their migration to online sales. And what of the suppliers? If you are trying to understand a market, surely it's very important to understand the consumer, the regulator, but also the seller. In truth, very little is known about these shy creatures that remain in shadow, and yet they are online supermarket. They are the online supermarkets of a $36 trillion market. Only a handful of research papers have attempted to understand their motivations and practices. Even the latest paper from the University of Australia could only manage to recruit 13 participants, and they were offered cryptocurrencies to get involved. So I thought it'd be interesting to contact some of them myself to hear the view from the shop floor. Similar work is being done, and much more comprehensively, by the US Drug Policy Alliance. Actually, yes, they would be doing that. This resulted in some fascinating conversations and a discussion paper that asked two big questions. How had COVID-19 affected their business, and would they be willing to help me reduce harm to their consumers?
Yeah, now the next subheading is people who sell drugs also practice harm reduction. Their answers to the first question mirrored what large-scale surveys and reports, such as the annual Global Drug Survey, had already told us. Essentially, I was told, drug use had developed its own version of the 5-to-2 diet, with shortages of product being followed by bulk orders encouraged through special deals and offers. As previous articles have pointed out, crypto markets are weathering the storm rather well. Interestingly, a range of unfamiliar and novel substances were available if your favourite chemical was not. And it's got in brackets alpha PHP, anyone? Question mark. Don't even know what that is, but anyway. That's one of the things in the world of younger people.
Yes, they are using and we know nothing of,
They're unfamiliar to me, yeah. The answer to the second question may come as a surprise. They were happy to engage with me in delivering safety messages on their page or in their packaging, including information on dangerous interactions with other drugs. As filtermag.org recently reported, people who sell drugs do practice harm reduction. I mean, if nothing else, you don't want your client base
to... You don't want them to be dead.
Yeah.
No. And it's a pretty sensible assumption. I mean, it could have been assumed long time ago, Jeffrey, 20 years ago, harm reduction messages as a supplier of drugs were really important. Take it easy. You can always have more. Don't have that much. Always, you know, you really need your clientele to come back to you and not to spread the word of your participation in the drug market to people you don't want them to. Now, you need cooperation of your consumers to not give your name to the police. You don't get cooperation with consumers unless you're prepared to be somewhat kind.
It became evident that the suppliers that I spoke to saw themselves as business people with a genuine passion for what they were selling. Many had used and enjoyed a range of substances themselves. Though the acquisition of wealth was a driving force, so were positive experiences with the chemicals that they were selling. This is an interesting twist on the popular narrative of the dealer as being purely motivated by money, and also reminds us that the distinction between user and dealer is often paper thin. Clearly, quote, my sellers may not be representative of the whole sector, and as recent research has pointed out, crypto market suppliers can be seen as being on the front line of the gentrification process of the drug business. However, these conversations show that some sellers recognise the importance of a healthy and happy customer base and are not primarily motivated by a wish to harm their clients.
Drug suppliers are in an ideal position to contact those who are hidden from drug services. As drug-related deaths soar in the UK, in the United Kingdom, and while drug laws and policy continue to shamefully compound drug-related harm, surely we need all hands on deck to save people who use drugs, their friends and families, from freezing water. If we could stop name-calling, we could recognise that drug suppliers are in an ideal position to contact drug users who are hidden from services and excluded from the rest of us. They are able to reach these individuals with life-saving interventions, needle exchange, foil and naloxone, for instance, and harm reduction messages. Some suppliers are willing to help. Shouldn't we let them?
Quite an interesting piece, Marion.
It is an interest, and it actually, that question at the end is surely rhetorical, or surely it's rhetoric, but nonetheless, it's a potent question, and it goes to, I think, the image of the drug dealer as being greedy and, you know, the old...
A malevolent character,
A really malevolent character, and this isn't always the truth. And particularly the online dealers, where they are not related to a militia or home invasions, Jeffrey, where, you know, it's not a person-to-person service. It's actually...
anonymous.
It's very anonymous, and there is an intervening range of facilities that are used to make contact with the supplier and between contact with supplier and consumer, and then cryptocurrency rather than cash in hand, if you like. Mm. So it's an interesting concept to actually ask that question, why can we not use dealers when... dealers are connected. What else can you say?
I will mention for listeners, like next year, planning to do a series of specials on cryptocurrency, the dark web, younger generations of people who do purchase drugs through the internet.
Yes.
It's a fascinating area. And it's changed the whole dynamic of the illicit black market and sales of illicit drugs.
And that emerged more through COVID than at any other time. COVID actually enhanced the capability of dark web interactions, didn't it? Really brought it up to the surface and made it a primary source rather than just an occasional source of overseas drugs, rather. More was local. Yeah.
And way more people are accessing the dark web than I would have thought. Yeah.
No, look, I would. Well, given that I'm not on the interblog, yes.
We'll both learn.
We're learning all sorts of things all the time, Jeffrey.
I'll play a quick quick song, and then we'll come back. You'll realise why I said game, because I'm going to play Wicked Game by Chris Isaak.
Of course.
It's Chris Isaak. That's a beautiful song, isn't it, Chris Isaak?
It is, yeah. He's Wicked got a lovely game. Voice, really.
Yeah, and the guitar's lovely too. Okay, we're into the last 27 minutes of this week's News from the Drug War Front. We're in international stories, and this has just been printed in the current Rolling Stone by Shelby Hartman and Madison Margolin, the case for macrodosing. We've talked a few stories this year about microdosing of psychedelics for treating PTSD, et cetera. This is the case for macrodosing.
This is actually having a real trip, I assume,
this is going,
as opposed to just feeling vaguely out of
this. This is going the whole hog, I think. Yeah. Microdosing, where people take minuscule amounts of substances to change patterns of behaviour, has brought psychedelics back to the mainstream. But is there more to be gained with a much higher dose? Would you care for a drop of LSD in your morning tea? Or a capsule of psilocybin mushroom dust with your daily vitamins? Such is the daily regimen for those who've taken up microdosing, reporting anecdotally just how much this new psychedelic trend has changed their lives. Over the past decade, researchers have delved into how taking small amounts of psychedelics can help people combat depression, trauma, attention deficit disorder, and even physical pain. Indeed, author Iolette Waldman wrote a New York Times best-selling memoir about it, called A Really Good Day. While researchers like James Fadiman are among the most sought-after voices educating the newest generation of, quote, psychonauts about the wonders of psychedelics, albeit in minuscule, sub-perceptible doses. But can you really call yourself a psychonaut, a savvy explorer of psychedelic terrain, if you've never actually tripped? It'd be like saying you know what weed is like, even if you've only ever tried CBD. The data is limited, but so far it appears as though microdosing works for as long as a person continues taking microdoses. It can affect their mood and their health, which of course can also massively affect how they treat themselves and others, but doesn't typically lead to massive long-lasting transformations in personality and ideology, the way that tripping might. And so we arrive at the debate over microdosing versus macrodosing, or simply, well, dosing. Is one approach inherently better than the other? What are the benefits and drawbacks of each? And if you are new to psychedelics, is it better to dive into the deep end or to just get your toes wet?
For decades, people primarily started by diving in the psychedelic deep end. Microdosing just wasn't something being widely discussed in our culture. I'll just say, underline that, Jeffrey, it was actually being discussed in psychiatric circles in the early days when psychedelics were being used. LSD was being used fairly widely.
Microdosing? Or
no, macrodosing with psychiatrists.
Okay.
But the idea of using psychedelics to combat particularly reactive depressions and psychotic episodes was really quite intensely explored, actually, and in Australia too, when the hospital I used to work in, Broughton Hall. Anyway, back to the article. But as microdosing has grown in popularity, more people are opting to start out with the latter, that's macrodosing, unsure of whether they'll ever fully trip. Oops. Yes. Both our introductions to psychedelics began with an eighth of psilocybin mushrooms, or just over 3 grams of the dried magical fungus that smelled like feet. We washed them down with orange juice, which psychedelic lore told us would enhance the experience. And yes, citrus is proven to do just that. Early on in our psychedelic experience, it never occurred to either of us that mushrooms could engender an experience short of swirling kaleidoscopic pump patterns and a 6-hour trip. Take less than the standard dose of 3.5 grams, but why? Intention is everything. The higher the dose, the more likely you are to experience ego dissolution or an out-of-body sensation. This can be transcendent, spiritual, and healing, but can also be terrifying without the proper guidance or context. Psychedelics dampen a part of the brain called the default mode network. When this region is put to rest, the boundaries of one's self in relation to the rest of the world come down. It's at this point that we can experience a mystical sense of oneness and can more easily break old thought patterns or addictions. This is in part why psychedelic research at institutions like New York University or Johns Hopkins has shown great promise in administering full doses to subjects looking to treat anxiety, addiction, and other ailments. On the other hand, without proper context, prior education or set and setting, one's internal mindset and their external environment, a full dose trip might be too much for some people. After all, not every new psychonaut is a wide-eyed Berkeley college kid, versed in Aldous Huxley and Ram Dass, seeking, to put it bluntly, to trip balls. A newbie is more likely to have a safe, positive experience when a trip sitter or psychedelic guide is holding the space. I think that's really quite important, Jeffrey. It's a bit like just having somebody to supervise your freak out.
Yeah.
It's really important. The quality of one's set and setting will make or break a psychedelic experience. Yeah, I agree. That's not to mention the risk of psychosis or triggering schizophrenia if you have an underlying mental condition.
Yeah, it's interesting. They refer to Aldous Huxley as a youngster obed, Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley, which was a famous book about the impact of LSD, you know, connecting you to the universe and various other things. Okay, the piece goes on to say, so that brings us to the idea that some new psychonauts may indeed want to, quote, start low and go slow, as they say in the psychedelic community. After all, you can always take more, but you can never take less. That's something they say all the time.
That's one of our mantra, isn't it?
It is. Yes. In the case of microdosing for therapeutic reasons, the concept is that the psychedelic can offer you shifts in perspective the way a bigger dose might, without requiring you to spend a full day tripping, something that many people might not have time for or simply might just be afraid to do. It can also be a good way, some psychonauts say, of acclimating to the idea of taking a psychedelic before you macrodose. The research into how microdosing works neurologically is in fact limited, but according to a database of more than 1,500 reports collected by Federman through his microdosing website, people report that microdosing can, in subtle but important ways, impact how they move through their day. They say they just feel lighter, more appreciative, more observant, more creative, or more grateful, amongst other effects. Federman gives examples informed by these reports, such as, on a day when microdosing, you might habitually reach for those chips or that glass of wine, only to realise that you'd genuinely rather have a salad or a cup of tea. Microdosing can just provide a bit more awareness or flexibility around changing unhealthy patterns. Quote, there's a spectrum of experience. It's definitely valuable to go all the way in, but it depends on the scenario, says Mike Margolis, activist and founder of Psychedelic Seminars. Goes on to say, if I'm trying to have a mushroom experience that is healing and therapeutic and I'm trying to get insights, then I probably want to do a higher dose. But if I just want to use psychedelics socially and hang out, then maybe a threshold dose, about 0.25 to 1 gram or just over a microdose is more appropriate. And not to mention, he adds, you can get insights from this lighter dose too. Quote, when you have the window just slightly cracked open, but when you're not totally in the full-on mystical or psychedelic experience. To be clear, psychedelics are not a panacea. Taking a full dose is not a magic bullet, and neither is microdosing. The key is integration, incorporating psychedelic insights into daily life. Whether that means practicing meditation to increase mindfulness or implementing a major life change like ending a relationship or switching careers. And if you're keen on microdosing, well, there's nothing wrong with simply seeking a little pep in your step or to better flow through your day. So while many seasoned psychonauts agree that the journey is the medicine, that getting through a trip provides insights that wouldn't otherwise be had, there is no right or wrong answer to the microdosing versus macrodosing debate. But there is a caveat to note, and that's the gentrification of psychedelic culture through an emphasis on microdosing. When CBD got big, many of us hailing from pre-legalisation, i.e. pre-mainstream cannabis culture, argued in favour of the case, quote, for keeping cannabis weird. Sure, getting high isn't for everyone, although anyone may be a candidate for the therapeutic effects of cannabis, such as through CBD or even microdosing THC, but that doesn't mean that we should stigmatise those who do get high in an effort to sterilise the culture and make it more palatable to the mainstream. Mm. The data has shown that there is value in macrodosing, in having profound classic psychedelic experiences, and so many long-time psychedelic advocates simply don't want to see that get lost.
It's sounding like a certain amount of elitism filtering into it, doesn't it?
You know, and those people who
actually who wants to dive in and actually get stoned? Is that intellectually a less respectable way of using a psychedelic than microdosing? So the debate is interesting nonetheless,
isn't it? But it seems to me that all perspectives have validity and use, doesn't it?
Of course, Jeff. Intellectual snobbery has, you know, playing a part in drugs, micro or macrodosing. For me, it's just an extension of the debate that we've been having for 40 years.
Yeah.
It's a moral debate. Is it okay to get stoned or not?
Mm.
Don't be an intellectual snob about it just because somebody gets stoned on something you like to microdose on.
Keep an open mind.
Absolutely. Mm. What a good idea. We're already seeing drug development companies that are trying to fundamentally change the psychedelic experience to make it more accessible. The US military is funding research into psychedelic compounds that don't make you trip. Well, the FBI and CIA used to kidnap people off the streets of New York, as I understand it,
to trial
psychedelics
to
see what it did to their brains. And Canadian pharmaceutical company MindMed is developing a psychedelic off switch as examples. That, quote, there's a culture of aversion to the psychedelic experience that is coming out as psychedelics are being mainstreamed, says Margolis. I would say that our culture doesn't quite understand the value of the psychedelic experience itself. You should be afraid of the psychedelic experience. That's the point. But that doesn't mean you should give yourself a quick release or avoid doing it. It means you should approach it respectfully because these things are powerful. And I think that would be our citation too, Jeffrey, wouldn't it?
Yeah, look.
Be careful, be respectful.
Yes.
You're mucking around with your mind.
Yeah.
And you don't know what the long-term effects of that are going to be, or we don't know what the long-term effects are going to be.
Don't be cavalier. Be absolutely sensible.
Be sensible. Keep your feet on the ground. And so in that may lie the answer to the microdosing versus macrodosing debate. The answer itself is completely objective and highly personal. If psychedelics are indeed sacred and, yes, certainly powerful, what kind of experience will engender for you the most long-lasting benefit?
What a fascinating piece, Marion.
Indeed.
And
really
thanks to Dave for passing that on to me from Karma. We'll go to a song and then we'll wrap up the show. I thought I'd pick Janis Joplin's Get It While You Can.
Oh, I'd like that. You know I like a bit of Janis in the morning.
Here's Janis Joplin. The mighty Janis Joplin and Get It
Bless
While You Can.
Heart.
Yeah, what a magnificent voice. Mm. Look, we won't have time to do this full story, but it's an interesting one from thecrimereport.org. It's entitled, The United States Needs a Smarter Drug Strategy in Latin America. I think
and
that's an understatement.
Yeah, that's speaking, yes.
This is a sample of it. It says, offering a blueprint on drug policy for the incoming Biden administration, a bipartisan commission has called on Washington to develop, quote, smarter policies to reduce both the supply of illicit narcotics in the Western Hemisphere and the demand for them. Quote, an increasingly complex threat requires a more agile, adaptive long-term strategy, the Western Hemisphere Drug Policy Commission stated in a report issued this month. We need smarter international policies within an interagency effort led by the State Department. Conceding that American counter-narcotics policies have at times caused considerable harm in many countries.
That's an understatement, isn't it?
The commission argued that the number of lives lost to illegal drugs in the US continues to make US action essential. Nearly 500,000 Americans have died from drug overdoses in the past 10 years.
300,000 have died from COVID in the past 5 months.
Yeah.
2 months, actually. It's had another third wave. Yes, but nonetheless, that's a large number of people, Jeff.
Some critics have called on the US to abandon its support for a militarised approach overseas that mirrors the war on drugs at home, now discredited by domestic critics. And Latin American leaders have begun moving towards drug legalisation, have called on the United States to do the same. Last week, notably, the House of Representatives voted to decriminalise marijuana strategy, although few people expect the measure to pass in the still Republican-controlled Senate. The Commissioner's made clear it was time to move beyond war on drugs rhetoric. We need an open and honest debate that should first acknowledge that the war on drugs is the wrong metaphor. Drug prohibition is not a conflict where one side wins and the other loses, but a complex ongoing effort to enforce laws designed, at least in theory, to protect public health.
So we're up to United States stating the bleeding obvious. I might just pop to the end of this, Geoffrey. The commission was chaired by Shannon O'Neill, Vice President, Deputy Director of Studies, senior fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Other members include Clifford Sobel, Vice Chair currently and managing partner at the Vela Capital Group, and previously the US Ambassador to Brazil from 2006 to 2009, and Sam Farr, a former Democratic Congressman who represented California's 17th and 20th districts from 1993 to 2017. There's also General Douglas Fraser, retired former head of the US Southern Command, Southcom, Pete Gallego, former Democratic representative of Texas 23rd District. So there's some really interesting people on it, including Dan Restrepo, who served as special assistant to former President Barack Obama on Latin American affairs, Matin Salomon, a former Republican congressman from Arizona, who was chair of the House Subcommittee on Western Hemisphere and the Asian Pacific.
But what are their recommendations? This is what they've said. The State Department should develop and lead an interagency effort to counter transnational criminal organisations and lower the supply of illegal drugs. So that's no change. Second, drug certification and designation process should be replaced with more effective mechanisms to evaluate the efforts of other governments and sanction those who stand idly by. For example, the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs should review country efforts to reduce drug trafficking and determine whether existing US sanctions are effective.
Not UN.
Third, US ambassadors should devise multi-year agreements with foreign governments that outline shared goals to fight organised crime, strengthen criminal justice institutions and reduce corruption. The report's fourth and fifth recommendations are to have the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy provide data-driven assessments of domestic and foreign counter-narcotics efforts and to ensure that the US Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network has ample resources to investigate financial crimes respectively. The Commission believes that those recommendations lay the foundation for a cost-effective interagency strategy with carefully targeted policies to curb the flow of dangerous drugs into the United States.
So it's crap, really, Geoffrey.
Well, it's essentially more of the same.
Let's do more. And I keep on saying, Winston Churchill did say the United States will eventually do the right thing after they have tried everything else and failed. So, but it seems to me that they haven't finished trying everything else and failing yet.
They haven't changed their thought pattern. They also said they agreed that curbing the international trade of narcotics was unlikely to be successful without addressing the huge market for drugs
really?
In North America.
Wow. Do you mean looking at people who need drugs and why they might need them?
Look at the cause, not the symptom. But, yeah, look.
This is just,
I hope for a slightly more enlightened attitude with the new administration, but I wouldn't put my last dollar on it.
I wouldn't bet on it. I actually think the war on drugs is probably going to get more funding, not less, because they're going to have to look mainstream for someone, Geoffrey.
Well,
don't you?
There's too much invested in it. That's the problem.
There's so much money invested in it. I mean, just look in Australia to see that, but the United States, most of its international foreign policy has an element of drug enforcement.
And yet individual states have gone the other way. We've got states that have legalized.
Internally, absolutely. And that's given us the opportunity to see what's going on inside the United States. But their external policies under Trump have taken a big dive.
Yeah.
So now they're going to get back involved in the world. Does that, by the look of it, it means they're going to get back into DEA-type enforcement. Crap.
Yeah, well, it provides a political cover for their coups.
A context for interfering in other countries.
Yeah. So you don't let go of that lightly.
Absolutely, not when you're that potent anyway. So are we up to
that's the end of the show,
going home
pretty
time?
Much, yeah. We'll have another show next week, 10:30 till noon next Tuesday. So listen in for that.
Yeah, and news from the drug war front from Jeff and Marion, or Marion and Jeff, depending upon whether you're going alphabetically or generically.
And seriously consider being a financial member of
2XX Public Radio. It's such a powerful way to get involved in the community and to have your voice heard.
They don't get too much funding. No. They get a little bit from the AC government. Most of it, I think, or a significant percentage comes from...
I think it's self-generated from these...
Members.
From members. And by being a member, you get the opportunity to also be on the radio eventually if you so desire. Or you can just sponsor the publicly... The locally produced,
it's worth
things
doing.
Like us. Yeah,
it's worth doing.
Even if we can't get words out at the end of the show, we can still do it in the middle.
All right, that's it for this week. We'll leave
see you
with
next
the
week.
Theme song for the show, which is "Golden Brown" by the Stranglers. Take care, stay safe, and we will be back again next week.
Bye.
Next Tuesday. Bye for now.